You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Mireya Solis. I'm the Night Chair in Japan Studies, and it's a pleasure to welcome all of you this morning to a program we have on modernizing trade rules in the world economy. Almost 2 years ago, 12 countries signed the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. And a central goal for the negotiators was to modernize trade rules, given that they had not been updated at the multilateral level, with the WTO unable to conclude the Doha round. But the goal of the TPP was also broader. It was about disseminating trade rules so that other countries could use this to enact domestic reforms. And China clearly was a country that was in the mind of the negotiators. Now, the American withdrawal from the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement a year ago represented a major setback. There's no question about it. But it was not an insurmountable obstacle. Just last week, the remaining 11 countries were able to reach a final agreement. And now we have what we call the TPP-11, or the Comprehensive and Progressive TPP. So many labels now attached to this resurrected trade agreement. So the TPP disciplines are alive, and they are influential because they also serve as benchmarks to other ongoing trade negotiations. For example, the attempt to modernize the North America Free Trade Agreement. So today we have gathered a panel of top experts to discuss the opportunities and challenges of disseminating TPP standards in two critical areas of the world economy: the digital economy and internet governance, and competitive neutrality and state-owned enterprises. The United States and Japan, at this moment, do not share membership in the TPP, but they do share the goal of advancing, of disseminating these disciplines. So the plan for today for this panel is as follows. First, we're going to discuss why rules on state-owned enterprises and digital economy are so important. Also, what was accomplished in the TPP, but also what was left out. What is the next frontier, if you will? And very importantly, I have asked all the panelists, and they have consented to discuss in which ways could Japan and the United States continue to collaborate in advancing these rules, even though they're navigating in a very different environment. Now, since you want to hear from the panelists and not me, let me just very briefly introduce them. I'll just identify them, and then I'll ask them to come to the podium in that order. Joshua Meltzer is a senior fellow in the Global Economy and Development Program here at Brookings. Maki Kunimatsu is chief policy analyst at Mitsubishi UFG Research and Consulting, and also a visiting professor at Chuo University. Amy Porges is the principal of Porges Trade Law, PLLC. And Tsuyoshi Kawase is professor at the Faculty of Law, Sophia University, as well as faculty fellow at the Research Institute of Economy, Trade, and Industry. So we have a very exciting program. If I can ask Josh to come to the podium. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Thanks for that introduction, Maria. It's great to be here, and what a great timing, in fact, given that the President's made TPP potentially relevant, at least to talk about in this country. So I'm going to talk briefly about the digital trade dimensions of the TPP. I'm probably just going to spend a little bit of time giving a brief overview of why this matters for the US and globally in terms of the internet and data flows and what's happening on a global level, and then we'll have a look at some of the trade rules around the internet economy and where the TPP and now the TPP has made progress. So, importantly, The expansion of global data flows has been, you know, very significant. This picks up really the notion of the flow of data between some of the key nodes in the system, just looking at submarine cables and essentially, you know, the capacity that's on these cables. And it really just sort of shows that you can see between the US and essentially the EU, we've had the most significant capacity installed, and data flows are really twice what they are between other parts of the world. But the growth in data flows now is very much between the United States and Asia, China and Japan and the like. So just a couple of obvious data points around the fact that we've had a very significant internet growth and access globally. So approximately half the world is online, but obviously that means another half remains offline, and there's a big digital gap there in that respect. People are getting online in a mobile capacity, so that's well understood in terms of the penetration of mobile phones and smartphones, and that's in the developing world. I think importantly is to think about this very much as an economy-wide opportunity, where there's a lot of debate and discussion about, you know, the very large internet companies, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and obviously they're very significant players in this space. But the benefits from the use of the internet and data is very much an economy-wide phenomena. For instance, the United States International Trade Commission, who looked at this in detail in the context of the US economy, came up with the conclusion that about 75% of the gains from the internet for the United States economy were not in the IT sector. You know, they're in manufacturing, they're in agriculture, services, retail and the like. And a lot of this is having very significant and important impacts on international trade and how international trade is conducted, and I'll talk about that in a little more detail. There is no fixed definition of actually what is digital trade. This is just one definition which has come out of the WTO e-commerce work program. The work in the WTO is very focused on this notion of e-commerce rather than this broader notion of digital trade. But I sort of wanted to highlight there this notion of digitally enabled trade, or the way data flows enable trade. So we're talking not only about essentially, you know, the capacity to sell things online, but we're also talking about how data enables a whole range of activity, which then contributes to international trade. So maybe through improved productivity and competitiveness, which makes companies more competitive. We're going to talk a little bit about how new digital services are very global in nature, and they're very much part of digital trade as well. So another challenge with this issue at the moment is that the actual measurements on the importance and the impact of the internet and data on economic growth, on jobs, on productivity, on trade is sparse. Part of that really just stems from the fact that statistics agencies do not collect this data. It's very difficult to collect at one level because of the economy-wide impact that this is having. And there's a lot of work underway in international organisations to get a better handle on this. And so I've just picked up a couple of statistics here. This is a McKinsey Global Institute assessment about the impact of global data flows on global GDP, which comes up with a very large figure there of 3.5%. UNCTAD recently released their report on the digital economy, and they focused on the e-commerce part of it. This $25 trillion is not just the digital trade element, that's actually e-commerce sales internally and cross-border. They managed to sort of pass out what they thought was the business-to-consumer element, which is actually the very small part of e-commerce sales anyway, and that was, you know, close to $190 billion. The number's obviously significantly larger if you factor in B2B sales, and that's really just e-commerce. But it gives you a sense that, you know, this is becoming a very significant part of digital trade. So, you know, I mentioned it previously, but it's worth underscoring, really, the key driver and importance of this for countries and economies is going to ultimately be the impact on innovation and on productivity. So if you look at, say, for instance, in the United States, certainly one of the key productivity drivers in the 1990s was through investment in information and communications technology. And the notion is that, you know, a couple of decades later, we're really into a data-driven economy, and that's where a lot of the gains are going to be from innovation and productivity. Now, there's a big debate, obviously, around why productivity numbers are low and, you know, why this hasn't flown through into improved productivity, and it's a global phenomenon. And I'm not going to go into that in much detail now, but, I mean, certainly that's the notional understanding of what the importance of this is in terms of, you know, the impact on economies and on trade. I think it's worthwhile diving in a little bit just to understand how businesses use data in a little bit more detail to get a sense also of the cross-border nature of things. So cloud computing, for instance, which is essentially, you know, providing distributed access to computing power, you know, whether it's sort of applications or services or infrastructure globally. So you have, you know, data centres which may be located, you know, in various parts of the world, but essentially you can be anywhere and you can have access to all these types of digital services. And it's actually quite hard to sort of overstate the importance, I think, of cloud computing on the way it's transforming essentially the computing in the IT landscape and how businesses work and are enabled. In many respects, if you think about the telecommunications revolution, which has gone from, you know, fixed to mobile and the impact that's had on lives and on growth, I mean, cloud computing may be of that magnitude. You can be a business of any size today, you know, situated almost anywhere, and you can get online and have access to the type of sort of computational power that large businesses only had access to. So, you know, the benefits are potentially very significant here. The United States, of course, actually in this field in particular, is very dominant, and so this is a real sort of growth opportunity for United States businesses as well. There is the Internet of Things, and a lot of this actually, I should say, is actually increasingly based on cloud computing, but the Internet of Things is essentially the idea that the sensors are increasingly embedded in things, which is then basically sending data back to centres where it's being recorded and analysed for new insights, and there's multiple applications of this, and this is only the beginning, really. You see it being used quite widely, and we all have experience of it with FedEx, for instance, where you can track, you know, what's happening with whatever you've bought off Amazon, but, you know, this is a global phenomenon where supply chains are being managed, you know, very accurately, you know, using, you know, RFID devices and understanding essentially, you know, the movement of goods in and out of warehouses and allowing just-in-time manufacturing and this type of thing. But increasingly we're wearing, you know, sensor-enabled technologies on our people. You know, if you have a Fitbit, for instance, that's an Internet of Things device that's sending, you know, data back which is being analysed, and you can imagine the applications of going into the homes, into smart cars and the like. And this is going to generate enormous amounts of data over time. So this is a big data phenomena, which is essentially, you know, the idea here is not all that new, but it's basically the gathering of large amounts of data, like data sets which have been sort of larger than what we've sort of been used to analysing before, and the application of analytics to that data to generate insights. So the big data is not really the new thing, it's the ability to derive insights from them. In some respects, it's a capacity to aggregate data sets across borders. You know, if you're doing medical trials and you can actually have populations that you can sort of do trials in different parts of the world, and you can derive insights a lot more rapidly and the like. But certainly this is being used by governments, it's being used by researchers, it's being used by businesses, and it's very much a global phenomenon. So taking this into sort of a more formal digital trade thinking about it, the way I sort of think about this is in terms of four major transformations. And, you know, that is the idea that it's having an impact in terms of the ability to be on platforms, to sell online, on the services, on essentially services value added in manufacturing or service citation of goods. And we can talk about that in global value chains. So digital platforms is probably the most straightforward one. You know, you can be on eBay, you can be on Alibaba, you can be on Etsy, you can be on Mercado Libre, and you can be a small business and you can be reaching customers globally and immediately. So you basically can become an exporter and you can become global in a way that was not possible before. And this is really having a significant impact, particularly on how small businesses can engage in international trade. It's sort of sometimes referred to as this democratisation of international trade. And there's some good data which actually supports this opportunity for SMEs, and not just in the developed world, but this is very much a global phenomenon. You know, whether we're in India or in China or in Europe, you know, this is actually happening. Trade in services can obviously be increasingly, you know, delivered online. So you can think about, you know, professional services. You can be an architectural service. You think about when you download software, you get access increasingly to a whole range of services over the internet. And so the internet is creating this new opportunity for that to happen globally. global value chains. In a sense, we spoke about this a bit in terms of the use of, you know, radio frequency identification devices, the RFIDs, tracking and tracing. But you think about basic things like communication, email. I mean, a lot of what's enabled global value chains and that disaggregation of production has been information communications technologies. It's been the internet, it's been data flows globally, and that continues to be the case. There's an interesting question about, you know, as we move into this increasing transition from goods into services, whether we're going to see more localization and how what that impact on global value chains can be. But certainly at the moment it underpins a lot of this global production. And the digitization of goods is really sort of a transformative thing which is going to affect trade, but it's going to affect production broadly. And this is, to some extent, the idea of smart manufacturing. You know, Germany's got their platform industry 4.0. There's the Industrial Internet Coalition in the United States, which is really looking at how data and internet and connectivity is completely transforming the manufacturing space and turning a lot of what has been the value of manufacturing is increasingly coming from these sort of overlaid digital services rather than the actual goods production. You can think of an extreme example like 3D manufacturing, where you imagine the scaling of that technology, and essentially, you know, the trade in goods becomes a trade in a design to a 3D printer located in another country, which then prints the good actually close to the location of the customer. But you think about, for instance, you know, a large goods producer, for instance, like Caterpillar in the United States, which produces, you know, what is undoubtedly a major good which gets exported globally. You know, Caterpillar provides now a whole range of essentially over-the-top services. They monitor their machines in real time. They provide analysis about how it's being used in terms of grading. They can determine when parts need to be replaced before they actually break down and communicate with relevant factories and have those parts delivered to where those machines are, so you minimise downtime. So they're, in a sense, beginning to sell solutions rather than goods. Rolls-Royce, for instance, you know, which manufactures jet turbines, sells now packages which are based on the hours in the air that the plane is rather than purchasing the jet engine per se. So they basically provide a solution which is a payment based on how many hours the plane flies, which is, you know, includes servicing and maintenance and monitoring the aeroplane and making sure that, you know, downtime is minimised and the like. So you can see how this is transforming business models as well. So just briefly, while we've got a fairly open internet and global data flows, what we are dealing with is an increasing environment where there are barriers and restrictions to the movement of data globally. To some extent, as the opportunities are becoming global, governments are paying a lot more attention to what this means in terms of their regulatory agendas. There's various other concerns about, for instance, Iran's got the halal internet, you know, which prohibits, you know, access to particular content, which it deems, you know, offensive to Islam. You know, China blocks apparently 11 of the top 25 global websites, and up to 3,000 websites are blocked in China, you know, for various political and commercial reasons. You know, you've got security concerns overlaid with that, where governments increasingly feel that they need data to be local, whether it's law enforcement agents getting access to data in case of, you know, law enforcement issue, you know, concerns about other governments snooping on their citizens' data and the like. And so we're seeing a whole range of measures being proposed and introduced globally, which is actually having the impact that data is being increasingly restricted and less global. So what have we got in terms of international trade rules? Well, the World Trade Organization rules, which were negotiated really in the late 80s, early 90s, before the internet was, you know, anyone was thinking about it, doesn't directly deal with any of this. But notwithstanding that, there's actually a lot of content in those rules which are relevant for digital trade. And I've sort of listed out here probably some of the main ones. The General Agreement on Trade and Services is probably most significant, partly because we've had some appellate body decisions which has confirmed that essentially when you've made a commitment on a market access, that includes a delivery of that service online. So a lot of the market access commitments that countries have made under the GATS also includes, you know, digital delivery of that service, and so there's that. There is essentially a commitment on the free flow of financial information in the WTO as well. The Trade Facilitation Agreement, which came into effect last year, which is sort of the latest, I guess, plurilateral agreement that they did, is important because it really simplifies customs procedures, which is important when you think about small businesses selling goods online and you think about the movement of small value goods, and customs becomes very important. The information technology agreement, which reduced the price of technology used to enable internet access and a lot of these digital services, has gone down because of the WTO, and that's been important. Intellectual property is increasingly a key enabler of the digital economy. We go back to the smart manufacturing example, and you're trading in a design. I mean, essentially, you're trading in an IP right. So, you know, when you download software, you're to some extent trading in a license. So you need effective intellectual property rules really to underpin a lot of this new movement of digital services. The telecommunications annex has been contributing to the to competition in the telecommunications market and the cost of internet access. TBT agreement from a standards perspective, and there's been an ongoing agreement among WTO members for a moratorium on application of customs duties to electronic data. So the US has obviously also got a whole range of free trade agreements, and you know they have all had e-commerce chapters, which has had a range of commitments there which have been relevant for digital trade. You know, basically, this is what they've done. They've sort of, you know, there's been non-discrimination between digital products. There's been actually a recognition of the importance of privacy. There's been a commitment, rather than this ongoing moratorium, an actual commitment on the electronic commerce side. There's commitments around paperless trading, consumer protection online, and the Korea FTA, which was sort of the last large FTA before the TPP, sort of did an important step forward around commitments to the free flow of data, but it was not sort of a complete binding commitment. It was really one of best endeavours in a sense. So the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know, the US really led a major effort to beef up rules on digital trade in that agreement, and the outcome was, you know, very significant. And this is not a complete list. I just wanted to pull out some of the main ones, the ones that I consider most significant. So there's a commitment in there now to the free flow of information globally. So this gets at this issue that data flows globally are really important for, you know, the way trade's conducted, the way businesses are conducted, subject to a GATS Article 14 style exception, and we can talk about that. There's a commitment to avoid data localization requirements, again subject to an exception. There's a commitment around not disclosing source code as a condition of market access or investment. There's a recognition of the importance that everyone has internet access and use of applications of their choice. And they sort of expand on the privacy issue and talk about essentially saying, look, everyone's going to go and approach privacy differently. It's got to be robust, it's got to be strong, but these regimes need to be interoperable and we need to work towards that. Of course, all these FTAs have got commitments, you know, in intellectual property, standards, competition policy. You know, so this is a broad agenda and other elements of the trade agreements matter, but we won't go into that in detail now. And so that leads me to the latest iteration, the Comprehensive Progressive. I actually kind of wish I hadn't called it that, because I'm not sure what they call it if the US rejoins. Is it no longer Comprehensive and Progressive? And I'm just going to call it the TPP. And really what they did was they suspended provisions, right? So they haven't actually excised these provisions from the agreement. I'm actually sure what suspended quite means, but you know, it seems to signal that they're open to these provisions coming back into force under the right circumstances, and one would assume that is when the US, if it does, decide to rejoin at some point. And I picked out just a couple. I mean, there's actually a whole lot in there that's suspended, just to sort of highlight some where they've suspended them which are relevant for the digital part. So there's no extension of the copyright term. There's no new protections for rights management information, which is, again, a copyright issue, and no obligations to have safe harbour. And safe harbour, which we all know is a Digital Millennium Copyright Act in the United States, which is this sort of balance between what internet service providers are meant to do, take down a notice for hosting copyright infringing material and the like. And, you know, so, you know, the US is, you know, these are not there. Now, it has to be said, a lot of these are already in the United States bilateral FTAs, and the US has got bilateral FTAs with, I think it's 6 of the TPP 11 that are left over. So it's really, you know, there's no FTA with Japan. You know, there's no FTA with Vietnam, with Malaysia. So there are some countries where these do not apply. So I don't think from a US perspective it's terrible at this stage. We've obviously now got the NAFTA negotiations where the latest report is 90% of the digital trade chapter has been agreed. That's not surprising given that they've already agreed to the digital trade chapter now in the CPTPP, which obviously Mexico and Canada are party to, and one would assume that, you know, in largely what we saw in the TPP is going to get reflected in the NAFTA negotiations. So I think this will be the next iteration where we actually see US participation. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Good morning. It's a great honor of mine to join you this morning. Thank you, Maria and Brookings Institution and distinguished panelists, namely Amy, Joshua, my esteemed friend Kawase, and all participants. This morning, I'm going to discuss how we should develop trade rules for digital economy and internet governance. For this take, first, I will go through recent phenomena in regulatory policies in several countries. And second, look into TPP e-commerce chapter, and finally share a view that there are several fora in which the US and Japan can cooperate and to contribute to disseminate TPP and develop beyond TPP rules for digital economy. After year 2010, or even within a couple of years, we have been observing several countries introducing new regulations and policies that would give a negative impact for free flow of data. Measures including restriction of cross-border data flow, data localization, prohibition of data processing abroad, source code requirement and standard assessment for essential goods and equipment. These measures appear in variety of forms. Written laws are easier to market players, while intransparent proxies will give uncertainty, and policy announcements sometimes give unforeseeability in case there is no information of concrete timing of enforcement. Each measure has different target data, from sensitive data such as biometrics or to public domain data came out from publicly funded researches. There was a roadmap, for example, focusing on M2M, or machine-to-machine data only, for localization in India. Targeted player of measures also vary. These couple of years, over the top service providers, in addition to internet service providers or telecommunication service providers, becoming in the scope. Sorry, I'm Thank you very much for your patience. Now I'm back. And, well, here we go. Okay, this is the one. Well, Asian countries, including China, have laws and regulations and draft of laws or policy papers that include data localization that you have to put your server in their countries or restrictive measures for cross-border flow of certain data. Some of them are sector-specific, such as financial sector or healthcare sector, while others are horizontal in nature and have the broader scope. While some of the measures might be regarded as digital protectionism, of course there are certain measures necessary to fulfill legitimate public policy objectives. We basically share the notion of balance between policy objective and acceptable exemptions from existing trade agreements, including Article 20, like Joshua listed up. We basically agree that at least we need certain measures to protect privacy, consumer, national security, public order, intellectual property, competition, and so on. So accumulation of WTO dispute cases help to draw the line of balance between protectionism and policy objectives. Also, agreements under WTO and chapter of FTAs provide issue-specific and sector-specific legitimacies, such as prudence in financial services sector. The important challenge in front of us for future rulemaking is to identify acceptable measures acceptable in the sense of a combination of form, scope, subject, methodology, process, which is not more burdensome or harmful for digital trade than necessary to achieve our policy goals. For this sake, our team of Mitsubishi UFJ Research and Consulting, which is a private think tank I belong to in Japan, is now working on mapping measures of selected countries as a part of METI study project to help identify the balance between legitimate policy objectives and protectionism. The study is yet underway, and now we are learning different types of measures. Some of them are already within the scope of TPP, and others fall in the traditional GATT or GATT services agreement or FTA chapters. Therefore, provisions of existing trade agreements are still effective to give discipline for digital transactions. Also, we find that there are certain blank or empty spots in our map, where we could encourage other countries to keep it as it is, not to introduce additional regulations. Our interview and questionnaire surveys to business sectors in Japan and abroad finds that business sectors prefer the scope of measures as limited as possible or as clearly defined as possible, of course, for achieving cross-border business and creating new business models. Sharing of successful business models by using blanks of environment without restrictive measures may encourage countries stepping back from introducing new measures. APEC or Asian Pacific Economic Cooperation may be appropriate place to do this kind of exercise. Last week in Tokyo, head of delegates agreed to sign TPP 11 agreement in forthcoming March, as Emilia introduced, and without amendment of TPP Chapter 13 that provides the most advanced set of rules to govern e-commerce. The e-commerce chapter is based on years of works in several international fora. TPP is the first FTA to successfully include mandatory rules for data free flow, data localization, and the source code. This we call three principles of TPP e-commerce chapter in Japanese trade community. As we are observing, measures inconsistent with these principles have been introduced or are under preparation of introduction by non-TPP countries. Dissemination of TPP principles will be a challenging and urgent task. There are still issues in TPP e-commerce chapter, however, this is a wonderful chapter but still have challenges, especially some exceptions of obligation in data free flow and data localization provisions give large discretion to the government of each member. Legitimate public policy objectives can be rationale for exceptions so that legitimacy has to be further identified. best endeavor provisions are also legally weak. There are also questions regarding effectiveness of coverage, dispute settlement function, and private sector contribution to TPP. While several countries are introducing new measures, it is essential for US and Japan to improve and disseminate this e-commerce chapter of TPP or notion or spirit of TPP chapter, e-commerce chapter. For this sake, each channel and forum would be fully used in accordance with characteristics thereof. Through current text of TPP has some challenges, we can expect it would be developed in a better shape by going through negotiations and discussions in different international fora, including other FTAs. We have successful experience of upgrading sets of rules in trade agreements. For example, WTO telecommunication agreement with reference paper, which is pro-competitive paper, was rather simple and have unclear definitions when it was entered into force in 1997. Step by step after that, through the series of negotiations of FTAs and works under international fora, the set of provisions was upgraded and now have clearer definitions and stronger functions to govern new situations not appeared at the time of WTO telecom negotiations, such as number portability, for example, or international mobile roaming. Let's expect wisdom of negotiators and the interested parties, including private sector, for development of e-commerce chapter and digital trade rule. Given the multi-layered trade rules and multi-channeled external economic policy, it is effective to seek all possible ways to disseminate favorable rule for US and Japan. Bilateral economic cooperation between the US and Japan is one of the fora that could aim to achieve TPP plus with less discretion. Other FTAs, both newly negotiated and reviewed, and dialogue channel will be fully used for Japan. RCEP, which is among 12 countries, and the Japan-China-Korea dialogue are ongoing, so they can be also used. WTO continue to be important as digital economy is relevant to almost all the agreements and activities under WTO. Development of work would be expected and a new initiative on electric commerce declared by WTO ministers in December last year. APEC has been an innovator to develop soft rules such as CBPL, cross-border privacy rules, and new trade agreements such as IDA. In 90s, it is an appropriate forum for US-Japan cooperation initiative. This year, APEC Papua New Guinea put an emphasis on digital. Concrete outcome is expected among different positions of APEC economies, open cyberspace-oriented US and Japan, and also managed cyberspace-oriented other members, and the digital divided focuses on. So that's the end of my presentation. Thank you very much for your patience. Thank you.
I have no PowerPoint, and I will try to keep this short. I'm here to talk about the state-owned enterprise chapter of TPP. As we all know, the WTO is stuck. All the action in trade negotiations and trade liberalization is now in FTAs, and I'll start with a punchline. The state-owned enterprise chapter in TPP was also one of the most popular innovations in TPP. I think it's been very influential from the moment the U.S. first tabled its proposal in October 2011. There was great interest by other governments. It's come up in other FTA negotiations. Other governments are thinking, how can we do this too? Because it's a common problem. It's a widespread problem. I think the TPP approach to it isn't flawless. It can be improved upon, and it will be in NAFTA. I think this has been a very successful example of policy entrepreneurship by the U.S. government, and it's going to become a standard subject in ambitious FTAs. And including the other really good news is that the TPP 11, that is the comprehensive and progressive TPP, adopts, it's a really elegant design where you have an umbrella agreement which simply incorporates the TPP text into it by reference, minus some provisions that are suspended, and the suspended provisions don't include the SOE chapter. So basically everyone's on board, all of the governments, even those that were initially, you know, somewhat reluctant. So I'm going to start with where the TPP SOE chapter came from. It actually came from the U.S. It came actually from the U.S. private sector. And I think the business support for this chapter is one of the secrets for why it has had this kind of sustained support. In 2010, service industries in the U.S., other industries, manufacturing as well, were quite concerned about a rising presence of state-owned industries in the global economy, and specifically their effect on markets for services in various countries in East Asia, including China, India, Vietnam, elsewhere. So the idea, the effect of government favoritism for their own SOEs, such as, let's say, insurance providers that used to be owned by the government, okay? SOEs and national champions made it really hard for foreign service companies to compete. And this was a concern for a broad spectrum of the mainstream U.S. business community. And these concerns exist today. You'll hear about them from Professor Kawase. They're a little different, but they're still there. And it was also the considered opinion of the business community the existing rules weren't doing the job. GATT has had from the beginning something called Article 17 on state trading enterprises. It isn't really aimed at the kind of state-owned enterprise that we have now. It's something about something like a grain trading company, a single-desk trading company like the Canada Wheat Board. But even in dealing with that, it hasn't really delivered good results. So it has a loose obligation to act in a manner consistent with the general principles of non-discriminatory treatment and a loose obligation for enterprises like that to make purchases or sales solely in accordance with commercial considerations. But the GATT doesn't really define what that means, and the jurisprudence has been, let's say, disappointing. So meanwhile, the OECD has been working on a concept called competitive neutrality. First developed in Australia, the idea that government business activities shouldn't enjoy a net competitive advantages over their private competitors just because they're owned by the government. Competitive neutrality. And the OECD work, of course, has been very influential, but, you know, it's not binding. It wasn't creating the kind of binding norms that the business community was interested in. So in 2010, the Coalition of Service Industries decided to collaborate with the U.S. Chamber. They, on a policy initiative, Charles Levy, the counsel to the CSI, and I were the counsel to this initiative, which eventually folded in informal collaboration with the other mainstream, broad-based business community organizations. The Chamber and CSI put out a report in early 2011, and started talking it up. They met with various interested parties in Washington, in the government, and the report had identified the problem, which was distortion of competition created by foreign government policy measures favoring state-owned enterprises and state-supported enterprises that were sponsored as national champions. And the thing was, the report proposed that we needed new rules. We needed new rules, and where were those rules going to be taking place? In the TPP. By then, by 2010, the Obama administration had decided to go for the TPP as part of its strategic pivot to Asia, a strategic pivot to unite East Asia as an alternative to the Chinese narrative. That's what it was all about, to make ambitious trade rules for the 21st century that would compete with China. So U.S. FTAs had already dealt with state-owned enterprises in the Singapore, Korea, most seriously Singapore FTAs, and even in NAFTA. But we wanted something new. We wanted something more serious, and we proposed that they do it in TPP. Not just because it was the only game in town, but also because the TPP includes some economies that are in transition or not in transition with a major state presence in the economy, like Vietnam, Malaysia, and Singapore. So there was a good argument that state-owned enterprise provisions could make market access more meaningful in the long run. So the administration decided they liked the idea. There was also support by the steel industry and also labor for this concept. It was very helpful. There was bipartisan interest on the Hill, bipartisan. And eventually, in the Lima round in October 2011, USTR tabled a text in the competition subgroup, and the negotiations began. It took some time to get liftoff. When Canada and Mexico joined in December 2012, it made a huge difference because they were very actively interested. Japan joined in 2013 and proved to be a really good partner on this issue because of the concerns of the Japanese government, which you'll hear about from Professor Kawase. And finally, after a lot of false alarms, TPP closed. So where are we at now? I'll talk about what's in the chapter. The final chapter is, I think, a genuinely new type of trade discipline. It's not great. It's not perfect because it had to allow for the defensive interests of all those 12 governments at the table. It's not perfect. And, in fact, the defensive interests included the United States. To some extent, we have met the enemy and he is us, right? It happens. But it's there, and the thing is, the architecture is there, and it can be built upon. We now know how to do this kind of obligation, and we can do it better the next time. So the parties have agreed to ensure that their state-owned enterprises make their commercial purchases and sales on the basis of commercial considerations. Here's a carve-out. Except when doing so would be inconsistent with the public service mandate. They also agree to ensure that their state-owned enterprises or designated monopolies don't discriminate against the enterprises, goods, or services of other parties. And these are obligations that bind the governments to order their... The governments are bound to ensure that their state-owned enterprises deliver on these obligations. Remember, the governments themselves are bound by separate obligations in the TPP agreement, not themselves to discriminate, you know. So these extend on those non-discrimination obligations elsewhere in the TPP. So the chapter also has a negative list architecture. That is, it has a set of basic rules with some broad exceptions, and then it provides for exemptions that are bargained out by each country for lists of non-conforming activities of state-owned enterprises. Again, right, more exceptions, right? But the thing is, the basic rules and the availability of these specific, country-specific, issue-specific exceptions, they affect each other. The fact that you can have non-conforming activities made it possible to have more ambitious basic rules. There is a trade-off there. So the first question is, what is a state-owned enterprise? What's the scope? The chapter applies to activities of state-owned enterprises and designated monopolies, but only activities that affect trade and investment between the parties within the TPP. A state-owned enterprise is an enterprise that is principally engaged in commercial activities in which a party, and it's limited to SOEs where the party directly owns over 50% of the share capital, or controls through ownership interests, exercise of more than 50% of the voting rights, or holds the power to appoint a majority of members of the board or any other equivalent management body. Right, so it doesn't cover minority-owned SOEs. It doesn't cover enterprises that have, let's say, a golden share, one golden share held by the government, for instance, in Singapore. And this is a weakness, right? It's not perfect, but we can do better later. And it also doesn't cover, very important, it doesn't cover enterprises, companies that are not principally engaged in commercial activities, like, for instance, hospitals. Okay, nobody wanted to cover hospitals. Nobody. So there is a separate category of designated monopolies covered by this. These are privately owned companies that are given a monopoly right to buy or sell a good or service. And they also include monopolies that are owned or controlled by a TPP government. So all so these are the new entities that are covered by this chapter. It really expands disciplines on these entities, at least potentially. So the parties have to ensure that these SOEs act in accordance with commercial considerations, and it defines what commercial considerations are. These are long definitions. The definitions were very well. During all those years of negotiations, they did a lot of very good work on the definitions. So the SOEs have to act in accordance with commercial considerations and not discriminate against goods or services supplied by an enterprise of another party or by a covered investment or of a foreign investor of another party. So there you have it's reaching out to cover discrimination of against foreign investors, services or goods. It covers services. It doesn't just cover goods. You have similar obligations for designated monopolies, and these are really an improvement on GATT Article 17. They're clearer, they avoid the problems that have been created by the WTO jurisprudence. So each party has to ensure that when it's state SOEs, state enterprises, or designated monopolies exercise government authority that's been delegated to them, they have to act in accordance with the TPP agreement. So you can't have your SOE, you can't delegate to an SOE, for instance, the right to license service providers and then if they do that, the SOE itself has to not discriminate as if it were a government. So there's another useful thing. There are further obligations. Administrative bodies have to exercise their regulatory discretion in an impartial manner, including with respect to SOEs. Also useful, right? Because that is, of course, another big problem where the government cuts their SOEs a break. There are provisions that ban automatic sovereign immunity for SOEs. And then there are elaborate disciplines on subsidies called non-commercial assistance provided by a government to its own SOEs, or subsidies provided by SOEs to other SOEs. And those were of great interest to a number of parties in the United States. I refer you to the text. They're very elaborate. And a non-commercial assistance is basically assistance to an SOE by virtue of its government ownership or control. Finally, transparency. Each party has to provide a list of its SOEs, and it has to answer upon request, provide information, a long list of possible information about things like ownership, shareholding, government connections, revenue, assets, exemptions that an SOE benefits from, all kinds of information that are normally not available for state-owned enterprises or haven't been available in these markets. These are exactly the questions that people often ask about Chinese SOEs, by the way. So, yes, there are exceptions, there are exclusions. Big issues that finance ministries care about, the finance ministries got carve-outs for, as they always do. Monetary policy, exchange rate policy, financial services regulation by stock markets, activities for resolution of failed or failing financial institutions. This was, after all, right after the crisis. Sovereign wealth funds are outside these disciplines if they're just doing asset management. So are government pension funds, government procurement, and also sub-central SOEs and designated monopolies at the sub-central level. Now, that is a good question. That's something that could change in the future. And small SOEs, okay, with under a certain value threshold, the current 200 million SDRs, which is about $291 million. So that's where we are now. Where do we go from here? Obviously, this is not flawless. People have said, oh, gee, net of the exceptions and the exclusions, what do you have? Is there no there? I don't think so. It can be improved upon. The TPP actually builds in a five-year review at which time are supposed to be discussions on expansion of coverage. And in fact, the U.S. can go farther with willing partners, and so could Japan. The U.S. will go farther, I believe, in NAFTA. NAFTA Chapter 19 had a few really narrow provisions on state-owned enterprises, very sketchy, but now the state-owned enterprise obligations have become one of the principal negotiating objectives in the TPA bill of 2015. They're a mandatory subject in all future U.S. trade agreements. And in fact, the administration has stated in its NAFTA objectives that they want a TPP plus SOE chapter as part of NAFTA. They want to expand covered SOEs so that they include situations of control through minority stockholding. And they could also consider covering ways to cover significant subcentral SOEs. That would be good. Canada and Mexico were quite positive about this idea in the TPP. I think the chapter is said to have been, as I said, maybe 90% done. Maybe all done, who knows? Close to completion. Of course, the big question is, will there be a NAFTA at all? We don't know. But I think there are many areas for joint policy entrepreneurship by Japan. I will leave those to Professor Kawase because I'm out of time. Thank you.
I believe I'm in a trouble. Does anybody help me out? Okay. So one moment, please. She's taking care of that. Okay. Thank you for your patience, and I'm sorry to have kept you waiting. And good morning, everyone. It is my great pleasure to talk to you this morning, and I would like to extend my gratitude to Mireya and the Brookings Institution. and for inviting me to this wonderful opportunity. And also my thanks goes to the distinguished panelists and the entire audience in this room and for joining us this morning. So this morning I will touch upon the recent developments and strategy regarding how Japan and the United States can disseminate TPP level or even TPP plus rules on SOEs and competitive neutrality. ever since the rise of state capitalism countries, including BRICS, market economy countries, including the United States and Japan, have been concerned about economically rational behavior by SOEs in the emerging economies. Market distortion caused by SOE is a consequence of governmental assistance with a variety of regulatory and financial tools and lack of stringent corporate governance on the part of the SOEs. Such concerns have been even more played up in the context of current development, including overcapacity and Made in China 2025 and One Road, One Belt Initiative. The existing international trade and investment agreement address these measures to some extent so as to ensure competitive neutralities. The centerpiece of this instrument is the WTO agreement, of course, and in particular SCM agreement to combat the unfair use of subsidies. The OECD and IMF guideline and recent FTAs concluded by the US also regulate the specific aspect of the SOE's structure and activities. That said, as you know, Amy and emphasized, and most of the controversial conventional economic rules only indirectly control SOEs and various important aspects of their activities and governmental support for them still fall out of the ambit of the rules. Also, some of them are even non-binding and not enforceable through any dispute settlement procedure. To fill this regulatory gap, TPP Chapter 17 offers the most, progressive SOE regulatory framework. But then I'm going to, skip this slide because, this slide substantially overlapped in, Amy's talk. And maybe, I should, skip this one too because, this also, overlapped in, Amy's talk. I'm losing my job. Well, anyway, under the circumstances, how can Japan? So, what kind of circumstance? Is TPP Chapter 11 is a kind of far from imperfection. Far from perfection, as the Amy emphasized. So, under such circumstances, how can Japan make the TPP level or even TPP plus rules on SOE prevailing in the Asia Pacific regions? My simple answer is that Japan itself should pursue this goal through a series of its own trade negotiation. We have already successfully done that this in the recent year concluded Japan EU EPA. Also prompt entry into force of the CPTPP or TPP-11 is the most important. I guess it is coming on March 8th, I guess. Right, Maki? Okay. Okay. And RCEP is also one of the best forums to disseminate high-quality TPP equivalent rules in Asia-Pacific. It covers ASEAN plus 6, including non-TPP state capitalism countries like China and prospective TPP parties like Indonesia and Thailand. Unfortunately, some parties seem quite reluctant to come to the negotiating table on these issues, and no major accomplishment can be expected. this RCEP reality suggests that establishing another set of hard laws regarding SOEs might be impracticable in the short term, and if so, a more cooperative and managerial approach would be an alternative. The last year, in the APEC Economic Committee, Vietnam raised an issue on internalizing the OECD guideline for SOE corporate governance and proposed to share the best practice for this purpose. To support this initiative, Japan shared its experiences regarding SOE governance in a policy dialogue at an August meeting of the committee. The framework for this, the purpose has been already established. At the second round of the Japan-U.S. economic dialogue last October, ASO and Pence agreed upon the basic scheme for the bilateral economic cooperation, as is shown in this slide. And in the Japan-U.S. summit meeting in November, the leader welcomed the result of the dialogue and agreed on their initiatives to establish a high-standard trade and investment rules, and cooperation on the enforcement of the rules against unfair trade practices in the third countries. Reportedly, several working groups composed of government officials have been established, and the discussion on SOE issues is a part of their mandate. In this framework, both countries are expected to jointly develop a new template for SOE rules, which will be made available to both of the countries in their own future trade negotiations with the third parties. The TPP text remains a good starting point for this purpose, but in consideration of the shortcomings, mentioned by Amy, the TPP plus are worth considering. The definition and coverage of the SOE should be broadened enough to include entity under substantial governmental influence, regardless of their ownership and structure. And also, it would be helpful to agree on a list of prohibited forms of assistance, as is found in the WTO-SCM agreement, as well as Japan-EU FTA. As a possible agenda item include higher level of transparency and better corporate governance in accordance with the OECD guideline. They should also make an alliance in multilateral fora. In the context of OECD and G20, they led the Global Forum on Steel Excess Capacity to the Policy Recommendation Atlas. While the U.S. government will never be satisfied with the forum's approach to simply set a capacity reduction target, still Japan and the U.S. should continue to play a leading role in the follow-up process to implement the recommendation. In the WTO, in facing the impasse of Doha Round, it is realistic to begin with a dialogue in like-minded groups. At the closing of the MC11 in Buenos Aires last month, Japan, the US, and the EU issued a trilateral joint statement declining the problem of overcapacity, and it was a good start to address the SOE issues in the WTO. Meanwhile, a aforesaid US-Japan framework put an even greater emphasis on the importance of rule implementation. A body of case law regarding unfair market distortion by SOEs has been developed in the course of the WTO dispute settlement procedures. US and Japan and the US could be a co-complainant in bringing cases against third countries, or at least mutually support one another as a third parties. Currently, a few large-scale cases involving SOEs are proceeding, and they will be a very good, touchstone, in this respect. In addition, both countries can utilize unilateral trade remedies for this purpose. Japan and the U.S. can concert trade remedies enforcement against the same unfair trade practice by a specific third countries. Japan's recent imposition over AD duties on the PET resin originated from China, following the same move by the United States, is a very good example. The investigation authority of both countries can also share information regarding SOE's unfair trade practices for future investigation. Technical assistance is another, you know, example of the practical cooperation. In fact, in the past few years, Japan's METI has been holding seminars on a regular basis, inviting investigators from US DOC and US ITC to share their abundant experiences, including those in SOE cases, with the Japanese counterpart. So I guess that's all from me this morning, and thank you for your attention and patience.
Thank you so much. That was a wonderful set of presentations. So many things on the table, and I'm sure that you'll have tons of questions. And I want to just table my question. I'm going to pose it because it may be that many of you are thinking along those lines. But then I'll open the, to the floor and take two more questions to make sure that I can take as many questions from the floor as possible. And my question has to do with the elephant in the room. I mean, China looms very large in today's discussion because many of its policies and practices challenge the principles of competitive neutrality and free flow of data. You have Made in China 2025, that strategy awards a central role to state-owned enterprises, and you have President Xi advocating the notion of cyber sovereignty and with a heavy emphasis on data localization. When the United States was part of the TPP, there was the expectation that this could then help encourage China to engage in domestic reforms, but those expectations were very much deflated when the United States left. So my question for the panelists, just to undertake later on if you would consider so, is in this new environment, What is possible? How can we incentivize, encourage China to engage in reforms that bring greater convergence on internet governance and reform of state-owned enterprises? And what is the right balance between rulemaking and enforcement? How we have a productive dialogue with China as we try to advocate these standards, given that the United States is no longer in the TPP. And we know, of course, that President Trump talked in Davos about a possible, that was a possible return to TPP, but I would make the guess that that's not going to be a swift return. There are many obstacles. Having said that, I want to open it to the floor, and there's people with microphones, so if you can please raise your hand. I'll take two questions. Super concise, please, so we give an opportunity to others to intervene. If you can identify yourselves and ask a very concise question, I would appreciate it. So any questions? Oh, so I guess I'm going to ask the panelists to take a lot of time with my question. Are you sure? All right, so what do we do with China and digital economy and state-owned enterprises? Oh, you have to press the button.
Okay, right, yep. It's a really vexed problem, and I don't think there's any obviously straightforward answer to it. I completely agree with your assertion. I mean, I think it's obvious that the US sort of was an own goal decision to leave the TPP. I mean, essentially, you know, much of what the administration has identified as challenges with its relationship with China would have been, you know, it would have been in a much better position to address in a more systematic manner if it had been in the TPP. And, you know, finding its way back to something like the TPP, whatever it may be, is going to be part of that at the end of the day. I think there is, on the cyber sort of digital side, a conversation that's been underway at different levels with the Chinese government about all the challenges that you identified. I think one of the key problems is that what China seems to have done is they seem to have turned what are essentially some serious economic issues into a security issue for them. And you have President Xi, who essentially heads that security apparatus now, and it means that I think the discussions become more challenging because you essentially have to convince the security side of the government that, you know, this is actually something that should be more open and more liberalised. And I think that will be increasingly difficult. So I don't see an easy solution at this stage. I do think, though, that what needs to happen is that the United States, Japan and the EU need to get on the same page with this issue. You know, I think what the issues that separate them are pale in significance compared to, I think, where the common ground is and the challenges, I think, that they all face with regards to where China's heading on this issue, you know, call for a united kind of response. And I don't think that... I think that it's going to require that type of common sort of action and common position, whether it's, you know, through bilateral dialogues or broader trade rules and the like, which is, you know, going to be required to get any significant, I think, change on the Chinese side.
Thank you, Josh.
Okay. I agree this is it's a particularly challenging on both sides for digital and SOEs because China, compared to 15 years ago, things have really moved backwards from our perspective. And I totally agree. I think the best possible recipe would be to go back to TPP. That's it. And in the interim, to form the best kind of team and start teamwork working to push back.
No, I think that there is clearly a debate underway. I absolutely agree with the premise. And, you know, empowering reformists, I think, has always been a core part of the agenda here for the United States and other countries. And I think that has to continue. I mean, this is still somewhat of a fluid situation. One of the things and there is a lot of work underway to do that. I mean, one of the things we miss a little bit of, which I mentioned in my presentation, is good data, I think, on what the costs of some of these policies are. I'm not optimistic that this would necessarily lead to a particular course correction at the moment in China, even if they had a better handle on it. But I think there's, you know, I think some of that work would help. I think that the US has to absolutely, crucially play a key leadership role on this digital aspect. I mean, I salute the Japanese government in particular for, you know, essentially filling some of that vacuum as the US left the TPP and, you know, really pushing the conclusion of the TPP 11. And I think it's really a fascinating observation that it's continued and that most of what was challenging in the negotiations remains in the TPP. I think it also speaks to a variety of things which we can get into. I won't go on, but I mean, I think it also reflects though a regional appreciation that China's presenting challenges not to the United States and Japan only, but to, you know, the Asian sort of economic mass at the moment. So I think there's a lot of potential alliances and partners in the region which can be utilised in this.
Thank you. I have one more question for the panelists, but I see a hand. Is that Claude? I can't see very well. Claude, please.
Missed the point that the United States is about to act. And I'd like to, and even with a feckless administration such as we have now on trade, I'd like to get your reaction to what the United States should do if it, as it seems about to do, is going to act alone on intellectual property, on the forced transfer of technology, on a variety of issues. It's a kind of fantasy to think that we could wait or go to the WTO, which could take a decade. But what should we do now, or if anything? On the cyber side and on the SOE side, both.
Maggie Sun.
Thank you very much for your question. For the cyber side, obviously, there are several fora that we can use. For example, the APEC is one of the flexible fora that you can enter freely, and then because there's less discipline in APEC, as you know, that's one of the really good fora. And then this year, this May, we are going to, well, Japan is hosting ABAC meeting, which is the APEC business meeting in Tokyo, and where that U.S. and Japan can work, both in the government side as well as company side, can develop something to, you know, the starting point of the rulemaking for the digital.
We have had, how to be diplomatic. You can't hear me. That's very diplomatic. Okay. Yes, we've had many, we're all reading the newspapers, right? Every day we are, this is the administration. Ever since January 2017, people have started using far more time looking at the internet than they used to. Right, because anything could happen any day. It's just that kind of environment. And now we have the Section 301 on intellectual property, which there are all kinds of rumors that it will be rolled out in the State of the Union, or that there will be a more gradual rollout, or whatever. And there are rumors about what might be done. There are rumors about tariffs. There are rumors about other things that the administration might do. All I can hope is that whatever is done won't be economically an own goal. You know, I sincerely, as an American, hope that the administration doesn't shoot us in the collective foot. And I certainly hope that the U.S. is consulting with its allies. A large part of what they're trying to accomplish, I guess, I hope, is to change the environment for China through what they're doing. And part of changing the environment is to get your allies saying stuff that supports you. And you can't do that if it's a total surprise to them. So I certainly hope that there will be advanced consultation. That's part of old-fashioned diplomacy. I'm sorry, that's not an answer, maybe, but I think it's actually kind of an essential element of the environment that we're in, that, as the president has said, America first is not America alone.
Thank you. Tsuyoshi-san, do you have a comment? Oh, okay. So my last question, if I may, because, again, I think we're all grappling with how different the world looks today. And when the TPP-11 was announced just last week, I think that one of the striking facts was how much of the agreement was left in place, as the panelists have mentioned through their presentations. And the idea was that the TPP would likely unravel without the United States because developing countries would not agree to the commitments on the rules area once they would not have access to the large American market. And this expectation did not pan out. And there were 22 suspensions, and the bulk of them, if you look at the actual commitments, were in the IP chapter and a narrowing down of the investor-state dispute settlement mechanism. But by and large, the state-owned enterprise provisions and certainly the e-commerce and a lot of the digital trade economy provisions remained. So I guess this brings the question of the resilience of these rules. And I would like to ask the panelists, why do you think that these rules, even though they had challenging for developing countries, have been so resilient and they made it through in the TPP 11? Okay, but we're almost out of time. If you can ask your question very concisely, I'll take that last question, the lady in the back, and then a last round with the panelists, and we'll close. Thank you. So that lady, thank you.
Thank you. So my question is, what kind of difficulties and core issues that you think prevent e-commerce from growing internationally?
All right, thank you. Last word from the panelists on this issue. Tsuyoshi-san, dozo.
Yes, okay. So I'm answering to Miriam's, second question. And I believe the SOE chapter was not the major obstacle to the TPP-11. As, Amy said, the level of ambition of the original text is very, not so high and acceptable to even the Vietnam and the Malaysia. And the Malaysia requested the modification of party-specific exception regarding Petronas. It's a oil national champion company. And this is the only suspension of the original text of, regarding SOEs. So Vietnam has already set about a drastic SOE reformation. I took an initiative, APEC talks on the corporate governance of SOE, as I explained. So this shows Vietnam's appetite and for the SOE reformation. And simply, Vietnam didn't need any suspension of the original text of the Chapter 11 of the TPP. That is my answer. Thank you.
All those exceptions and exclusions made this this chapter very digestible, right? But the basic thing is that I think it reflects a lot of interest in the business community everywhere in being able to compete more effectively with legacy state-owned enterprises. Mm-hmm. As for the digital chapter, my God, the digital chapter was, I think, one of the most popular bits of the TPP. It was being used. This was the big thing that the Obama administration was using to market the TPP domestically. I don't know how it was used in Japan, but everybody wants to be on the internet. I don't know anybody who doesn't want to be part of the information superhighway. It's a no-brainer. But so, yes, it was very, very, very popular. And it also has some very large businesses behind it.
Yes, very briefly about the e-commerce chapter in TPP, which is a very good set of popular ruling, but it has exception and room for the discretion. So it is not really the heavy problem for them. Thank you.
One of the things I think which goes underappreciated sometimes, particularly when you have long negotiations, which tends to be the norm, is the socialising aspect of these negotiations in terms of getting countries the time and the opportunity to actually learn about the new rules which are put forward by whichever country it may be, and to think about, the extent these are in their interests. And I think it's really telling that at the end of the day, all countries, if you look at sort of what was, suspended now, it really speaks to the fact that, while there's sort of this ongoing narrative that the US sort of forces these rules down other countries and they're sort of forced to accept it and all the rest of it, you actually see at the end of the day, these trade agreements are ultimately about, domestic reform agendas which parallel what the governments actually want to do at the end of the day. And the US definitely pushes it on the IP side, which is, I think, why that's where most of the suspensions are. But in everything else, these really parallel where countries are going in the region from a whole range of development sort of, paradigms. And I think that's reflected in the fact that we've moved forward there. So I think it's interesting from that perspective and important as well. And on the digital bit, the big thing at the moment is getting more people online. I mean, to some extent, the digital divide is real and it's substantial and it's really, when you think about developing countries seeing digital really is in their best interest, and you think about the splits in the WTO around a digital agenda and elsewhere, they're still at the very basic question of you still need to convince us why this really is going to be helpful to us when, the majority of our people don't even have internet access. So I think making sort of progress on the infrastructure side still matters.
One last thing. For getting the next billion online, they're going to get online not through through their computers. They're going to get online through cell phones. Mm. It's the mobile internet that really matters most. The mobile internet, which is powered by cell phone towers and also by big data, by apps on your cell phone that pump data up to the cloud where it's processed and it's returned to you. So the whole infrastructure, including mobility of data, is going to be necessary to get all those people online with new payment solutions, new apps, new everything. So I look forward to that, and I'm happy that TPP has helped to facilitate it, even if the U.S. is not on board.
All right. Well, thank you so much. It's been a terrific discussion. Please join me in thanking the panelists.